Blog Talk Radio.
Coming to you live from the Blog Talk Radio Studios in the heart of Hudson County. Folks, you know it's always in Union City, New Jersey. Insider NJ proudly brings to you Politically Direct. And I am the professor, Fernando Uribe. I want to welcome you all here tonight, the 13th of February. Yes, we're still going strong here in 2020. And I want to thank you all for listening from wherever and however you may be doing so throughout Hudson County, throughout the Garden State, and to all my good friends throughout the good old U.S. of A. You can write to the show's inbox at any time, ladies and gentlemen, and it's Politically Direct, NJ, at yahoo.com. If you have any suggestions for topics or guests coming up, I'd love to hear from you, and I do answer my emails promptly, so again, feel free to write to me at Politically Direct at NJ. I'm sorry, Politically Direct, NJ, at yahoo.com. Sorry about that. Again, folks, Politically Direct, NJ, at yahoo.com. Get back to me. I do love to get emails from fans. Again, I like the show. What you don't like about the show, again, without feedback, the show doesn't get any better. So as I said before, I depend on you, my low listening audience, to write to me, and you do, and I appreciate that. So again, don't forget to follow the show on Instagram, at Politically Direct NJ. Also, check me out on Instagram as well, at Professor Fernando Uribe. Certainly, I appreciate all the new likes and all the new followers. I know a lot of you enjoy my Instagram stories, some political memes, some sports memes, some pro wrestling stuff, pop culture, everything in between. I know you enjoy them, and certainly it's nice to see the traffic on there. Don't forget to hit me up on Twitter, folks, at Professor F. Uribe. And for all you Facebook subscribers, please go to the official page for Politically Direct. Like it, of course, share it on your walls, and tell your friends to do the same. Now, I do want to hear from you tonight at some point, ladies and gentlemen, so don't be shy. Call me toll-free, 818-572-8032. Once again, toll-free number tonight, 818-572-8032. And our toll-free number is brought to you by Insider NJ. Now, don't forget to check out Insider NJ, ladies and gentlemen, by going to www.insidernj.com for the absolute best coverage of the political scene throughout the state of New Jersey. The best journalists, really, and that I have the privilege to work with. It starts with our editor-in-chief, Max Pizarro, and certainly working our way down the lineup, as they say, with Jay Lasseter, with Fred Snowflack, as well as Al Sullivan, and many more. So I'm proud to be a part of the Insider NJ team. So once you go on the website, folks, upper right-hand corner, you'll see the subscribe button. Click on it, and you're automatically enrolled in the morning intelligence briefing. And again, it's the best journalism, the best columns, the best articles, everything that you need to know about what's going on in the Garden State. Hey, nobody does it better than Insider NJ again. Don't forget to like them on Facebook and follow them on Twitter as well. Again, www.insidernj.com. Don't forget to start and end your day with Insider NJ. Now, the opinions and views expressed every week here on Politically Direct are mine and mine alone. They do not represent those of Insider NJ, the management, the journalists, or the staff. Well, folks, happy President's Day weekend in advance. Certainly, you get to enjoy the great holiday, honoring all our great presidents from Abraham Lincoln to the very first president, George Washington. So Again, I do hope all of you enjoy the President's Day weekend, and a lot of you will be off on Monday. Please party responsibly. Uber and Lyft everywhere. I'm sure there'll be plenty of checkpoints around in New Jersey over the holiday weekend. You know, municipalities never waste an opportunity get any revenue from us, the motorists. So I was talking about that, as a matter of fact, on my local podcast yesterday about some of the draconian parking guidelines in Hoboken, New Jersey, right down the road from me. And I'm sure that there are other parking guidelines that are just as bad throughout the state of New Jersey. I know I see them down the shore when I go down to Long Branch and other Jersey shore towns. Just the parking regulations are just ridiculous. So whether it's that or just checkpoints all around New Jersey this weekend, I'm sure folks, please again, party responsibly. It is Valentine's Day weekend, so we'll be out tomorrow night, hopefully, out with your loved ones, your significant others, out having dinner. Again, make sure to be careful, again, throughout the rest of the weekend. So don't give municipalities a reason, ladies and gentlemen, to take more of your hard-earned money with, you know, summonses and infractions and all that stuff that a lot of police departments do across the state of New Jersey. So, it's really egregious. And as I said before, be careful with that. It was interesting. I actually got some grief last week on social media for a post that I put up there last Saturday. I remember being in Fort Lee, New Jersey, one of my favorite night spots, in Donna's. And I remember because I was able to, you know, park in a safe zone. And it was interesting because right across the street from Donna's on Park Avenue, which is interesting, there were just these signs here that, every municipality has 3-hour meter parking to some extent, right? But Fort Lee, I'll tell you something, for a town that makes as much money as it does off property taxes, right, and everything else, to squeeze people at the meters, right? There's an 8 a.m. to 2 a.m. Meter enforcement, except Sundays and holidays, and there's still signs for no parking from 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. So pretty much, folks, if you don't have some residential sticker or you are not parked in a driveway, you're screwed. So, again, it's just a reminder about some of these petty tactics that these municipalities engage in, whether it's these sort of, you know, parking enforcement rules or these checkpoints by police departments that oftentimes are just really invasive and bothersome. Just be careful, folks. Keep an eye out for everything. You know, municipalities are always trying to milk for money. So, again, folks, 818-572-8032 are toll-free number tonight. We have a great guest coming up in just a moment, so don't go anywhere. And, of course, our toll-free number is brought to you by Insider and Jay. And, folks, it just sort of got me thinking about the Justice Department this week, and that is the subject of my first shot. It was announced this past Monday that the Justice Department unleashed a legal assault on sanctuary jurisdictions across the country, and thus by filing a new round of civil lawsuits asking judges to overturn these policies and warning state and city officials they could soon face their own criminal charges for harboring illegal immigrants. Subsequently, Attorney General William Barr and the Justice Department filed lawsuits against the state of California, state of New Jersey, and King County in Washington State, each of which has adopted novel ways of interfering with U.S. immigration and customs enforcement's ability to arrest, detain, and deport illegal immigrants, which is their job. So it's kind of egregious for state and local officials who want to interfere with federal law. But nevertheless, the Attorney General said his department is taking a look at state and local prosecutors as well who pursue lesser charges against illegal immigrants in order to keep their rap sheets cleaner, thus keeping them off ICE's radar. Now, the Attorney General went on to say he ordered a review to see whether the Justice Department can use a criminal law that, quote, that prohibits the harboring or shielding of illegals in the United States against jurisdictions that have sanctuary policies. He also mentioned in the statement, today is a significant escalation in the federal government's efforts to confront the resistance of sanctuary cities, the Attorney General said in remarks this week at a dinner for the National Sheriff's Association, where he unveiled a legal barrage. He also went on to say, we will consider taking legal action against any jurisdiction that or any politician who unlawfully obstructs the federal government and the enforcement of immigration law. Now, the Trump administration has been really in a running battle with sanctuary cities, whose number has grown exponentially as sort of anti-Trump state and local governments seek new ways to thwart the president's get-tough immigration policies, and one that really he's been adamant about since taking office in January of 2017. So to me, ladies and gentlemen, you know, when I think about what Attorney General Barr is doing, and it's interesting because specifically here in New Jersey, the Justice Department's lawsuit challenges Attorney General Grewal's directive that requires local law enforcement to tell immigrants when they're being released, but bans them from telling the same information to ICE in many cases. U.S. Attorney Craig Carbonito said, quote, "The case seeks to restore the balance of power between the federal and state governments by reasserting the supremacy of federal law." Once again, New Jersey Attorney General Gobir Grewal blasted the new lawsuit against them as election year politics, pointing out that he issued this directive in 2018, suggesting that it was an odd sort of a peculiar way now that it was only now being challenged. The Attorney General here in New Jersey wants to say, quote, "What's disappointing is that my former colleagues at the Justice Department have agreed to go along with this election year stunt," as the Attorney General blasted the president and obviously Attorney General William Barr on Twitter this week. Well, folks, listen, I think you've heard this show consistently, and for all you fans out there that consistently tune in, I appreciate it. I've been always philosophically consistent and intellectually honest on this show, and I've never been a fan of sanctuary city policies and sanctuary state policies. And I know that the governor and attorney general here in New Jersey have been adamant in defying the president. You know, I think it's sort of just a very it's a reminder about the difference in ideologies when you have an overly liberal governor and an overly liberal attorney general, and perhaps a more conservative type of administration in Washington. Now, what's really infuriating to me is, folks, at the end of the day, I mean, taxpayer dollars are being exerted to fight this on both ends, where the federal government is, you know, exerting taxpayer dollars to file these lawsuits, and subsequently the state of New Jersey has to spend taxpayer dollars to fight this sort of litigation. And it just seems like if both sides just came to the table or at least acknowledged that federal law takes precedent, this wouldn't be happening. But again, as I've mentioned before, this is just the governor and the attorney general here in New Jersey bending over backwards to accommodate illegals. And I don't know about you, but that's just something that doesn't sit well with me. And I get it, you know, a lot of people who comment on Twitter or comment on the Facebook page for this podcast and say, well, Fernando Uribe is a bigot. Fernando Uribe is a racist. Fernando Uribe is a xenophobe. Folks, he's a spoiler. I am none of those things whatsoever. What I am is a law-abiding citizen who's also a taxpayer. When I see the governor and the attorney general, to a large extent, you know, bend over backwards and engage in every possible accommodation of illegals in this state, I don't know about you, never mind me, folks. Let's think of my parents who are immigrants who came here legally 50 years ago. And I understand that immigration laws changed dramatically. I get that. And I know all the narratives. I've heard it from liberal guests I've had on this program. That's fine. I'm not minimizing what they're saying, but I'm also a reminder that, you know, my parents look at this, you know, policy and are also up in arms, whether it's bending over backwards for illegals, with, you know, obviously by not cooperating with the federal government, by wanting to issue driver's licenses to illegals, by taking taxpayer dollars and consolidating them in a legal fund to help illegals. Like, no offense, folks. Like, and I don't care how this sounds, like, my taxpayer dollars should be going to help citizens, okay? And I don't want to hear this nonsense. Well, you know, illegal immigrants, you know, pay taxes too, Fernando. I want to hear this nonsense, okay? Because at the end of the day, the governor's responsibility and that oath of office he took, okay, in January of 2018, explicitly says to uphold not only our state constitution, but the United States Constitution, and to protect our citizens. This isn't protecting our citizens, okay? Because if you heard my opening monologue last week, it was reported in the New York Times, it was reported on NJ.com, it was reported also in USA Today, that ICE performed a very extensive sweep here in New Jersey between February 27th and I believe January 7th. I'm sorry, between January 27th and February 2nd, okay? And they rounded up over 115 dangerous criminal illegals. And these are people with shoplifting, okay, on their records, folks, okay? This isn't jaywalking summonses or tickets that these illegals have. These are dangerous foreign nationals. They're here living in New Jersey. Okay, and thankfully, I did their job. They rounded up these dangerous individuals, and hopefully they're facing deportation as quickly as possible. But if you leave it up to the governor and the attorney general, all you're going to see is them wanting to protect them by not allowing law enforcement to cooperate with ICE. And to me, it just seems like, you know what, we don't want to make ICE's job easier. We want to sort of throw every roadblock we possibly can in their direction. And no offense, like, that's not governance. I'm sorry. That just isn't. And I'm not an attorney. Okay. I'm not an immigration attorney either. Okay. I'm an academic. Okay. My graduate degrees are in political science and policy. So what I'm trying to talk to you from is the perspective of being, you know, an academic. And when I hear that the governor and the attorney general here in New Jersey, again, are bending over backwards to accommodate illegals the way they are, I don't know about you. Again, it doesn't make me a bigot. It doesn't make me a racist or a xenophobe. It makes me a concerned citizen. And you know what? Bravo to Attorney General William Barr. You know what? Maybe the governor and the attorney general will finally learn their lesson when the federal government comes down and puts their foot down here in New Jersey. Because maybe that's what needs to happen to sort of wake them up from these dangerous liberal policies. Have we not seen what sanctuary states and cities are becoming in this country, folks? Have you been to California? I've been to California. I was in Los Angeles just this summer. I drove through Los Angeles. What an absolute shithole, okay? It just is. And why? Because you have crazy liberals like Gavin Newsom driving California into the ground. And then yet you have liberals in New Jersey who are up in arms saying, well, let's make New Jersey the California of the East. Are you crazy? Have you seen San Francisco? Have you seen Los Angeles? Have you seen other parts of the Golden State? Folks, there's nothing golden about California anymore. And you want to make New Jersey the California of the East? Please, do me a favor. Folks, again, and I've said this before on this program, liberals overall will not stop until they completely ruin New Jersey. And you know what? They're on their way. And thankfully, Attorney General William Barr and the federal government are stepping in. We'll see where it goes in the weeks and months ahead. But again, I'm hoping that federal law wins out in the end. And that, folks, is my first shot right here on Politically Direct. Folks, 818-572-8032, toll-free number right now. Here, we have a great guest coming up in just a moment. So I'll take some phone calls later in the show to hear what you have to say about the opening monologue. And, of course, my guest at this time, joining us here at 950 on the East Coast, he is the esteemed political columnist from NorthJersey.com, also for the Bergen Record, a guy who I've seen and always very impressed with on Reporters Roundtable with Michael Aaron on NJTV, a very accredited and reputable journalist in his own right, the great Charles Style, joining us here on Politically Direct. Charles, what's going on, brother?
Well, thank you for that introduction. I want to share it with my wife, but you went too fast.
So, oh, listen, I'll send you the link.
I'll
send
you
the link
later.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay. Well, Charles, listen, bro. Well, listen, it's good to have you on here. I'm a big fan of your work. I read your columns religiously.
Oh, great.
You know, listen, you're as good as it comes in New Jersey, bro. Like, you have a good pulse of what's going on, and I really enjoy your style of journalism and just, like, you know, the way you tell a story. And I think the way you sort of convey the facts and what's going on in our political climate. So I just want to say thank you on behalf of a lot of New Jerseyans that read your work and appreciate it as much as I do. So, you know, hats off to you.
Well, I appreciate
for that.
That's very kind of you. No, I appreciate that. That's, you know, it's good to have people still reading newspapers, having them engaged.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and I love it when I get emails from readers, even if they like are really torqued off and, you know, they think I'm the living devil, I'll still write back to them as long as they give me their address and it's not some anonymous name. And usually that opens the door to a dialogue. So, yeah.
Absolutely. Charles, listen, I'm all for that. And being an academic and just a bookworm, I love reading. I'm still that guy that goes tangibly to the store and picks up a newspaper and likes to read it.
A real newspaper.
I like to get my hands dirty and then afterwards go to the bathroom, wash off
same,
the ink off my
same.
Hands. Hey, you know, I love it. And but I'll tell you right now,
absolutely.
I'm the typical guy. I read it from the back first. I'm a sports guy, so I read the sports first and work my way up to the front. So that's how I read the newspaper.
The key is that you put your coffee cup on the newspaper and create a coffee ring. If you don't do that, you're really not the real thing.
I probably have. I mean, I do it as regularly as I used to, but I know exactly what you're talking about, man. So definitely.
Not
well,
green
Charles,
tea.
Listen,
I'm talking about coffee.
No, I'm a hardcore coffee drinker, believe me. I'm a hardcore coffee drinker. I either drink it black or have a little bit of soy milk in it. So definitely love my coffee in the morning.
All right.
Charles,
okay.
A couple of articles here that I read recently from you, and I really want to get your sense of, you know, it is election season, and there's a lot to talk about, without a doubt, you know. And folks, again, if you haven't had a chance, you know, check out Charles and his great articles at NorthJersey.com. Again, he's been a great writer for the Brooklyn Record for quite some time now. And you published something just a couple of days ago titled New Jersey Democrats Are Splintered Over Who Gets Their Support and Are Nervous About Bernie. And Charles, I have to tell you, you know, I'm someone who, as a registered independent, you know, I don't really have a dog in this fight. I don't really have a horse that I'm invested in. But it's really interesting what's happening to the Democratic Party. I remember seeing your appearance on NJTV recently with Michael Aaron and Reporters Roundtable, and it was the week of the president's visit to South Jersey. And as a guy who loves pro wrestling like I do since the age of like 8, I love some of the hysteria. I love some of the craziness. And I have to tell you, I think the president created quite an entertaining day down in Wildwood with his endorsement of Representative Jeff Van Drew there. I think that's going to be a very interesting race, which we'll get to later in the show tonight. But, you know, when I look at just the political climate in New Jersey, it seems, though, Charles, that, again, I'm not trying to kick dirt on the grave because he's not dead yet, but it would look like maybe by the end of this month, the establishment candidate, I think a lot of New Jersey Democrats, like Governor Murphy, State Democratic Chair John Curry, and others, when they look at Joe Biden, I think Joe Biden might be after Nevada and South Carolina. I could be wrong, Charles. But if that's the case, what are the New Jersey Democrats going to do, in your opinion?
Well, I agree with you. I think Joe Biden is the walking dead. And I think a lot of people in the Democratic Party here are starting to realize that. And I'll tell you, the guy you really ought to keep an eye on is Bloomberg. I mean, he is snapping up endorsements all over the place. Mikey Sherrill, Josh Gottheimer. And now, you know, people like Janice Kovach, who's the mayor of Clinton, and she's an executive. She's on the leadership team at the State Democratic Party. They are aggressively knocking on the door of everybody in town. And I think the pitch they're making there's no viable candidate, no viable centrist moderate candidate in the field, really, that can really marshal the resources to take on Trump. Bernie will bring down ballot carnage and bring everybody down. And Bernie right now, you look at the math of the first couple contests and you look forward right through Super Tuesday, he is the putative front runner, and he could very well emerge as the nominee. So we are the fail-safe option. We, meaning Mike Bloomberg, and it's time to join now, and the earlier you join on, the better for everybody, including probably your own career if I'm elected. So I would I'm telling you, I think he is the guy that's pulling out here.
What's interesting, Charles, about the observation of Mike Bloomberg. No, that's fine. The interesting observation about Mike Bloomberg, Charles, is this sort of premise where I think really in the last few years we've seen that the traditional type of political climate no longer exists. And I know that in the news cycle for the last 48 hours we've seen outrage right by the woke right left in the country that looks at the recent audio tapes of Mike Bloomberg talking about stop and frisk policies from 5 years ago that he gave in an interview. And it's really interesting because I think the way that many establishment Democrats look at Mike Bloomberg as perhaps a savior, where, listen, this is a guy, listen, I'm, again, as I've said on the show repeatedly, I'm philosophically consistent and intellectually honest. Very much like the president was a devoted Democrat for many years in the 90s, right, and maybe some of the 2000s. You know, we know that Mike Bloomberg was the reverse. Bloomberg gave to Republican candidates. Rudy Giuliani, obviously, when running for mayor, he donated to George W. Bush for running for president. So, you know, Bloomberg, like anybody else, has been an opportunist. I don't blame him for that. But it would seem that that tape that surfaced in the last 48 hours would doom anybody else. And apparently it has not. It really hasn't sunk his candidacy. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it goes to the depth of the anxiety in the Democratic Party. If they were confident with somebody else, if they would not be looking the other way, because as we've been told so many times and the numbers show it, that the African-American community is a vital block in the Democratic coalition. And there's no way that they would that most African American voters would countenance the not only the mayor who that pushed forward stop and frisk, but was its staunchest defender. He was almost like a disciple of the procedure. So the fact that he's able to kind of mollify the base of the establishment party, and even to a certain extent some African American stalwart Democrats, by apologizing and admitting that he was wrong with this procedure, and then to have that create almost like a flicked switch in how they look at him, just to me shows you that that the real issue here is they are really desperate to win, and that they are really not confident that the field out there right now, those out in the field, are going to be capable of taking on Donald Trump in a knife fight.
That's a really good analogy. And folks, if you're just joining us right now, it's 9:30 here on the East Coast. And joining me this evening is the esteemed political columnist for NorthJersey.com and the Burnham Record, the great Charles Steele, joins us here on Politically Direct. Charles, you know, it's interesting that I was reading the article, and again, folks, if you haven't had a chance, do check out Charles's outstanding columns at NorthJersey.com. And as you sort of outlined here, listen, right from the onset, I think it was easy for New Jersey Democrats to sort of jump behind Cory Booker. I've met the senator. He's a nice guy. He's a guy I want to have a beer with and probably like chat, you know. But I don't know, Charles, I found Cory Booker's campaign to be very uninspiring. I think it was very blah. Mm-hmm. And I think that came back to cost him in a really crowded field. And of course, in January, Senator Booker suspended his campaign, and he's, really back in Jersey just looking to fundraise and certainly garner up endorsements as he's looking to retain his Senate seat, which, again, I think is relatively safe. You know, New Jersey has not elected a Republican to the United States Senate, I think, since 1972. I could be off that
right.
that date, but, you know. And it just seems to me that, Cory Booker's seat is safe here in the Garden State. I think that for the rest of 2020, I'd obviously be campaigning hard. I know that his companion in the Senate, the senior senator, Bob Menendez, obviously, I think, is watching this closely. Statewide, mm-hmm. I think, as I mentioned before, Governor Murphy, Chairman Curry, George Norcross, whoever. It just seems that whether, and I don't like to make a lot of the last couple of days, listen, credit to Bernie Sanders, just I think coming in barely in second in Iowa, winning barely just in New Hampshire. It just seems like the Democratic establishment, though, Charles, and I said it before on this program, I think the fix has been in to get Biden into the nomination, but it doesn't seem like that's going to be the case. I think, as you mentioned, I think he's a dead
right.
man walking. And again, a lot can change between Nevada and South Carolina by the end of February, but I don't see it happening. I think it kind of puts, and especially someone like Governor Murphy, who is a very unapologetic liberal / progressive, whatever you want to call it.
Right.
I don't know if, him and the establishment here feel comfortable getting behind Bernie Sanders, or perhaps maybe former mayor of
South
Carolina, Pete Buttigieg, is maybe a more safe choice, or even Elizabeth Warren. Have you heard any rumors, or what do your sources tell you about maybe where the governor and, State Chairman Kerr are leaning towards?
What I understand the governor is, position he's taking is the wait and the classic wait and see, just see how the field settles out. His problem is he's now a national fundraiser for the Democratic Governors Association, and his loyalties all over the place. There's no real upside for him to go out there and endorse somebody and then risk the possibility of having that person crater and collapse. He has the luxury also that the June primary, New Jersey's primary, is usually in early June. And usually by then the nominee, there's a consensus has galvanized around a pick, and the whole fight is a foregone conclusion. that might, you know, there's a lot of early chatter already, however, that that might, that, you know, that it may not be resolved before the June primary here in June. And we could have a, you know, there's even talk of a possible brokered convention. I think that's probably unlikely, but the point about Murphy is he can wait it out. He's kind of in, he has that luxury, and I think he's going to take it.
Listen, I'm with you, and I think because of the fact that the primary is not until June 2nd, it gives, you know, both the governor and the state Democratic chair, John Curry, who really, you know, was in a bit of a dogfight when we closed out 2019.
Right.
As we started 2020, obviously.
Yeah,
as we entered 2020, obviously, the chairman was able to sort of broker a peace among the party, as well as with Leroy Jones. So, obviously, he's saving his capacity as chairman of the state Democratic committee. We'll get to John Curry a little bit later. I really want to get your thoughts on that. But Carl, I have to tell you again, and, you know, reading this article, another article I really want to share with our audience today that really caught my eye, and you published this a few days ago, and, you know, it was a great title, you know, hashtag Me Too aftershocks being felt in New Jersey political circles. So notwithstanding the craziness about Mahwah Mayor John Roth, which we'll get to in a moment, because I really want to get your thoughts on that insanity over there with that crazy stunt. But you know what? I remember being in Reporters Roundtable last year, right in January, and I remember sitting on a panel on Friday as there were hearings taking place concerning the Katie Brennan situation. And I remember that obviously Katie Brennan is a very polarizing name in New Jersey. We know what's happened, allegedly what's happened. We've read committee reports and everything else. And Charles, I don't know about you, but I really find everything going on with this story, sort of like the layers of it, to be somewhat hypocritical, because I remember in the fall of 2018 when, you know, then federal judge, you know, Brett Kavanaugh was, you know, sitting there and during a very painful appointment process and confirmation hearing. And I remember sitting through that and feeling bad for Brett Kavanaugh, because he was being vilified by a lot of liberals and Democrats. And I remember the loudest cries came here in New Jersey. I heard the governor denounce Brett Kavanaugh, and he was emphatic. And so was Cory Booker, and, you know, with his selective moral outrage and everybody else, about denouncing Brett Kavanaugh and saying, you know, we have to believe women. We have to believe women. All I heard all fall 2018 was hashtag believe women, hashtag believe this, hashtag believe that. But the minute that Katie Brennan's story became sort of like statewide news, you know what, Charles, no offense to people listening tonight, it was such a 180, and it reminded me, and listen, I'm a center-right person, I don't apologize for that, but it reminded me about the typical liberal hypocrisy that happens with stuff like this. And during the Katie Brennan hearings, and then afterwards, you didn't hear a peep from the governor. You didn't hear a peep from any establishment Democrat in New Jersey about Me Too, about hostile work environments or anything else. And I just find this funny now when it comes to this committee that being formed by State Senator Loretta Weinberg, who, by the way, great lady, has been on this program. I like her a lot. But there's a lot of problems with that committee, though, Charles. But even before we talk about that committee, it just seems like this climate isn't going away. And it just seems like there's never any philosophical consistency when it comes to talking about these issues involving Me Too.
Well, I think the what you're touching on is that, you know, the Me Too, it's kind of loosely defined. It's widely defined. It runs the gamut from, you know, rape, allegations of rape, to just bad, boorish behavior, you know, such as the mayor of Mahwah getting drunk at an employee party and, you know, crashing in her bed without his pants or her permission to crash there. And, you know, and here's the mayor of a town hall that's predominantly where the employees are predominantly women. So there's this wide range of outrage, and, you know, anybody caught in that gamut of outrage is going to face serious consequences, possibly loss of job or worse. And so I think that is part of what's being sorted out here is where is the level of, what is the appropriate level of punishment for the crime or for the misdeed or the bad behavior. I mean, I think that's being something that's not been clarified yet.
And you know what, Charles, and folks, if you're just joining us right now, again, Charles Style, he is the political columnist for NorthJersey.com and the Bergen Record, a great journalist in his own right, joining us tonight here on Blog Talk Radio. Charles, it's a really complicated issue, though, right? Because it seems like
sure is.
We've been reading a lot in the news cycle about former employees, exiting the Murphy administration. We hear talks about hostile work environments. Again, going back to the Kitty Brennan hearings, I mean, this was such a circus. And it just seems like, you know, the governor, in fairness to him, has really, I think, escaped a lot of this unscathed. We don't know if this will come back to haunt him next year when he runs for re-election, because we'll see if it's being held against him. But right now, currently, the governor is treading water, I think. I think he's been able to escape a lot of the firestorm that this has created, I think, in political circles and public and in the court of public opinion. What do your sources tell you about the governor's thoughts about this?
Well, I don't know. It's unclear. I think there hasn't been a political reckoning for the governor, and you're 100% right. That's going to come in 2021. And I think if you look at the Republican candidates out there in the Republican Party, they sense vulnerability, and it's amazing how they're kind of circling the wagons around this issue. I think it was Jack Cittarelli demanding. I'm not exactly sure of his policy yet, but he's issued a statement about non-disclosure agreements. The state party chairman has spoken out against state NDAs and is making it calling for all candidates to don't hold me to it. I want to double check his. I'm committed to memory, but they're making NDAs an issue, and I think that's what they're positioning themselves for. The broader point I want to make here is that they are they see this as a big issue that they're going to exploit in the race against Murphy. I think their goal is to paint him as a hypocrite and a poor manager. Somebody who sort of floated above the fray and allowed this toxic work environment to fester on his campaign, and also a poor judgment of character. Some of the people that he brought into the campaign have run into similar problems once they've left New Jersey. I'm talking specifically about Liz Gilbert, his former executive director of the party, and the former political consultant from Hudson County who joined her in working on the 2020 campaign. I'm sorry, the 2020 Democratic National Committee's convention in Milwaukee. They were part of the host committee, and they ran into similar problems out there.
Adam Alonzo.
I just have a name which was somehow buried in the back of my 9:30 at night head here. So
sure.
I think the Republicans are really going to – they've made it clear that this early on, and far from even having a nominee, that this is going to be issue number one.
Well, and what's interesting, though, Charles, is, again, as I mentioned before, the committee that's being again, as you referenced in your article, the committee that's being spearheaded by the state senator out of Bergen County, the, quote, work group on harassment, sexual assault, and misogyny in New Jersey politics. That's a really long name there. Again, according, as you broke the story, it's scheduled to hold its first public forum coming up this Tuesday in Fort Lee. Apparently, the 15-member panel of women who have spent careers in politics and government has a fairly open-ended mandate. You've written its main goal is to listen to women share their experiences of harassment, assault, or intimidation in the workplace, and testimony will be made public in private and anonymously through an online survey operated by the New Jersey Coalition on Sexual Assault. Charles, I have to tell you, I talk to people statewide, as I'm sure you do. Maybe you haven't heard the same things I have. But there's some skepticism about this 15-member panel and whether or not the state senator has really compiled the right group of women for this committee. Have you heard that same type of chatter?
I really haven't, to be honest with you. I've heard unease about where it will go and where, you know, where it will where it will lead. There's a fear that this is so open-ended that it's just going to, you know, that the mandate seems is so broad that things might just get out of hand. So I think people are, I think there's some anxiety in the political ranks about that. But then again, I mean, it's touching on there's also on the other side, though, it says that, you know, women have had to endure indignities privately and maybe not so privately in the political arena in New Jersey for decades. And it's been building and building. And so finally, this committee is going to be a chance to give full expression to some of that. And at a moment when public sensitivities are heightened and are looking for some resolution about this issue. And, you know, maybe it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better. But on the other hand, a lot of people that I talk to say, you know, it's a painful reckoning that's long overdue.
I hear you. And again, as you referenced in the article, certainly incidents that have happened over years, whether it be the Chamber of Commerce, the train ride that happens, as a matter of fact, later this month down to D.C., or even in November,
right,
during the League of Municipalities. I mean, I love going to the League, but I can tell you firsthand, I have a lot of female friends that have told me privately, and they've asked me not to ever share their stories. But what they have told me to share on air anonymously is the idea that oftentimes the League becomes sort of, you know, a frat party on steroids.
Right.
Same thing with the train ride, the frat house on wheels. And it seems like, you know, certainly State Senator Weinberger, I think, wants to sort of get to the heart of the matter here and to, you know, try to sort out what's right, what's correct, what's incorrect, what's factual, what's not. And I'm with you. I think this has, while I think the intention is good, Charles, I think this could potentially be a disaster in terms of what is going to be spilled out there. And again, I'm not saying that we should get the facts out, of course, but this has the potential to be a disastrous type of endeavor, Charles.
Yeah, there's a question of people making, you know, this is a concern all the time with this issue, making very, scandalous allegations in public. And pointing the finger at somebody in public life and forcing that person then to, you know, who may not even be in the room when this allegation is being made, and then having to then, you know, scramble to defend themselves. And the concern for, I know a lot of people, you know, I've heard this too, is, you know, we're talking about allegations in some cases that could go back a long time. And so in a different era when the mores and attitudes towards this were different, and what was acceptable then is totally unacceptable now. And so I think a lot of people are, frankly, a lot of men, I'm sure, are nervous about being held to account for things that they may have said or done or years ago. I think that's part of the anxiety that this is bringing to the fore.
No, absolutely, Charles. And we'll certainly see once the committee starts on Tuesday what's uncovered in the weeks and months ahead. And again, great job by you with these columns. You know, Charles, I really want to get your thoughts on this. And part of, you know, my day job involves grading and educating. And, you know, at the midway point now, a little bit past the midway point of Governor Murphy's term. You know, again, and I think this is where, you know, I don't want to put you on the spot because you are a journalist, and I obviously the bread and butter of your profession is to be objective, right? Yeah, well, the bread and butter of your profession is to be objective. And while some people call me a journalist, I'm more of a commentator, and I give opinions on here. And
sure. No, I got you. I got you.
You know, I grade people every year, every day. And I think presently up till now, and this is me speaking as a homeowner and a taxpayer, I have to give the governor a C here, or maybe – actually, no, let me rephrase that. I'm going to give the governor a D. And the reason – and just like my students ask me, well, what's your breakdown, professor? Like, what's your criteria for grading? My grading criteria for Governor Murphy is this. We have not seen the governor have any ability to work with the legislature. And I get it that at times State Senate President Steve Sweeney makes that relationship difficult, and we'll get to that in a minute. But the governor just hasn't worked hard enough to really, you know, give us property tax relief. And some of these liberal policies, whether it's allocating tax dollars for a legal fund, Charles, for illegals here in New Jersey, whether it's really, you know, sort of, you know, going with the pom-poms and encouraging legislators to grant driver's licenses to illegals here in the state, whether it's just, again, the idea of tax, 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 and there's no relief in sight for us, I would give the governor a D. And this is not me being mean. This is not me being partisan, because I'm a registered independent, but I have to call it what it is. And at the midway point now, you know, there's still, again, the governor still has almost two full years to make the case why he deserves reelection. And Republicans are going to have to sort of make the bigger case as to why their side is going to have a better candidate. Again, I would give the governor a D here. I just don't see the governor passing right now. But, you know, your thoughts, what grade would you give the governor, Charles?
Well, I haven't thought the grades. I'd say anywhere from a C plus to a B minus, to be honest with you. It depends. I mean, if some of the things you mentioned and you're upset with are policies you disagree with, well, that certainly will skew your grade down. So I mean, we could have, you know, ideological and policy debates on those all day long, and we could have disagreements and we could find common ground. But if you're going to judge him on, I would say, his effectiveness and his ability to get things done, I think that's been his weak point. Now, you could argue on one – I mean, he'll argue, for example, that they have accomplished a lot. They've $15 minimum wage, pay equity, in their view, the driver's license, they followed through on that promise. And other progressive reforms that they believe were a mandate that voters certified in the election. Now, I dispute that mandate to a degree. I have problems with it. He should have, frankly, given the position of the state and then the weak opponent that he had, he walked away with only a 13% victory. He should have, some party operatives think that should have been twice that size. And the other thing is, most people really weren't. If you looked at some of the polling at the end of the race, they weren't even aware of who Phil Murphy was or what he really represented. All they knew of was that he wasn't Chris Christie. So I think it's a very weak mandate. But that, nonetheless, he has checked a lot of progressive boxes. He, with the exception now of really a millionaire's tax, and I don't see that really changing anytime soon. But you're right. When it comes to property tax reform, there really hasn't been much. He hasn't, when it comes to the pension benefits or really restoring the pension system to solvency, it really hasn't. It's really still on the same sort of treadmill. There's a general sense that he's just he's more soundbite than governing. That it's that he kind of floats above the fray and creates this. He's good at creating this brand as the progressive, but when it comes to actually governing and doing things, there's really not much to show for it. So that's where I would put him, you know, to skew it down towards the C plus range. And I agree with you. The legislature has been recalcitrant. It's been, he's at war with the the South Jersey faction led by Steve Sweeney and George Norcross, and they are not giving him much ground. But I'm not so sure that's always an excuse to not govern. I mean, you've still got to find ways to reach common ground on core issues, and I just see a lot of stalemate. I'll say one thing though. I'll give one big point of credit to Murphy though. He and his surrogates have framed this debate over the abuse of tax credits very well. They've really made that a priority, a real kind of arcane, complicated issue, and put that at the forefront of the agenda, and have made it as a proxy issue over the calcified, kind of corrupt party boss-led system in New Jersey, and they've really done a good job with that. So that kind of ticks his number up a little bit, his grade up a little bit as well.
You know what? That's fair, Charles. And it's interesting you bring that up, because I know at the start of the year, my first guest here in 2020 was Sue Altman, the executive director of the New Jersey Working Families Alliance. And as you can remember, Sue was very discreetly escorted out of the Capitol building, if you remember.
Yeah,
I
was there.
And I had Sue on the first Thursday of 2020, and she really went into detail. It was a really good episode. If you have a chance to catch the replay, I certainly urge you to tune into it. And
she's impressive. Yeah.
Certainly. And I remember to your point about the one of the things you'll definitely give a check plus to on the governor. And one thing I wanted to ask you, because I know that, as you mentioned, you know, some of the policy that he was able to sort of get through, at least working with the legislature, you know, the minimum wage increase to $15, obviously over a period of the next 4 years. But I'm going to tell you something, Charles, and this is something where, and again, and I'm fair on this program, and I can't blame the governor on this, but one of the mandates during his campaign was about marijuana legalization. And this is where I really want to crucify the legislature, because if you remember in March of last year, you know, both the state assembly and the state Senate were going to take votes. The governor was really adamant, hoping that he had the votes necessary. And I'm going to tell you something, man, what disappoints me about the legislature, and I don't really have a dog in the fight, Charles, because I don't really care about marijuana. Like, I've never smoked it. I don't care to. It's not my thing to do. I don't want to infringe upon anyone's right to do that. But it reminded me about the ineptitude of government. And this, and as I always tell my students all the time, my poli sci students, I'm like, it's this sort of just bungling at the state level that reminds us why, you know, we hate state government often here in New Jersey, where when they didn't have the votes in both chambers, they were talking about maybe putting it on the ballot last November, but because of the fear of low turnout, the state Senate President Steve Sweeney said, we'll move it up to November 2020. Charles, come on, man. As if we don't have enough to think about this November, right? I mean, to sort of put this
right,
on a ballot referendum now, I mean, come on. Yeah, I agree with you.
I think it is a cop-out to put it on the ballot. I do, however, I'm not so sure that this is a failure of the legislature. I think the legislature, in this case to a degree, is, I would say, adequately reflecting an ambivalent public. I mean, yes, the polls have shown strong support about legalizing marijuana, but when the rubber really hits the road and you start drilling in on subjects like how do you adequately test, what's the effect, how are we going to really keep this from kids? Yeah, I don't know. I just think that this is a democratic state, but I tend to agree it's more of a suburban, moderate, left-of-center state, that it's still suburban, family-oriented. I'm not sure it's really ready for it.
Well, I'm with you on that point, though, Charles. But my biggest bone of contention with the legislature is, okay, if you don't want to go that far, but at least sit down, buckle up your pants, pull them up, and work on at least some sort of coherent measures about decriminalization. You know, Charles, before I entered academia, I had the pleasure of working for the state of New Jersey in different government agencies, and I worked in our criminal justice system. And I saw a stat last year that blew my mind. We had over 14,000 marijuana-related arrests in New Jersey. So that comes out to about one arrest. That comes out to about one arrest every 29 minutes. And we keep incarcerating black and brown people at such a disproportionate level. And it's just wrong. And I get it that, listen, I'm not an attorney, Charles. I'm not going to sit here and insult our audience and say, well, listen, let's look at expunging records in an objective manner. But you have people all over the place here. You have Ron Rice saying one thing. You have State Senator Cunningham here in Hudson County, where I live, saying another thing. You have senators, state senators and assemblymen and assemblywomen in Bergen County, down to Middlesex, down to Monmouth, that they can't get their act together and figure out what's the right way to decriminalize this, Charles. And we keep incarcerating people. We keep having municipalities prosecuting people. And no offense, man, here's a newsflash. We have a much more serious opioid problem in New Jersey, and that's where our resources should be going towards instead of this insistence on incarcerating black and brown people, Charles. That gets me livid.
No, I totally agree with you. That is, to me, like, I'm ambivalent about it too, but I'm not ambivalent about those very issues you laid out, especially the incarceration, the inequity. The ACLU study of it found that the usage rates between whites and people of color are roughly the same, but the arrests of Latinos and blacks is almost three times more. And it's just the tragedy is, once you're in the system, once you're in the judicial system with a record, it's in one shape or another, it's almost impossible to get out. It's always with you. It's a real battle to get that out of your off your resume and out of your life. And so I agree with you. I think most people want to deal with that. And I know Murphy had made that, you know, initially the driving force. But the reality is, you know, you get it's kind of like a chicken and the egg kind of thing. If you decriminalize, then how does that affect legalization? And if you, you know, and how do you get rid of the black market if you decriminalize? You know, or if you legalize it without penalty. So, I mean, all these questions get surfaced, and I think it just becomes but there's so many different competing interests in the whole issue that it sort of just reached a Gordian knot, and I don't think there was any consensus or any leadership to really guide it through.
No, listen, Charles, you're right. And I think one of the biggest, I think, misnomers that exist here is, again, I don't have any polling right now. It's only February, so I can't really give you an intelligent sort of prediction right now. But, I mean, there's maybe a 50-50 chance, or slightly better maybe, that it could pass in November. And I think the biggest misconception is that New Jerseyans might have is just, oh, yay, you know, coming up November 3rd, yeah, you know, we're going to vote and legalize marijuana. Guess what? The morning after, on Wednesday, November 4th, Charles, yeah, the legislature, weed's not legal. So I don't, you know, people, I think, are under this misconception, like, oh, once we, you know, vote to legalize it, it's there. No, like, the very next day, I'm hoping, or in the coming weeks, that the legislature has to sit down now, and they can't put this off any longer. They have to sit down and come up with a sound policy. And it just seems like, as you mentioned before, I think you said it perfectly. New Jersey has been reliably a blue state for many years. I mean, there are pockets of the state that are kind of conservative, but it's kind of a purplish, you know, state overall, I think. It just seems like Democrats who have been in the legislature, or at least have been the majority in the legislature, Charles, for almost a quarter century now, just can't seem to get their act together on something. I mean, think of it this way. It took them a full calendar year just to sort out the minimum wage, right? Imagine just for them to have to sort this out. They might spend all of 2021 on this and still might not get anything done, man.
Well, that's absolutely correct. Just because the voters approve a ballot measure is no guarantee that you're going to see, dispensaries or storefronts selling marijuana anytime soon. They still have to hash out the enabling legislation, and that could take years. There's no guarantee that just because the voters give them the general broad authorization that's going to be an instant turnaround. No, it's not. We've seen a lot of ballot measures over the years go through this torturous process. So,
And it might be a process, Charles, that might not necessarily haunt Governor Murphy throughout 2021 as he runs for re-election, but I'm pretty sure it's going to be a sticking point for him because he ran on it in 2017. It hasn't gotten done. Again, it's not something I think that whoever the Republican candidate is going to be can really hang him out to dry on because, again, I think there's, as you mentioned, there's a certain ambivalence that exists among New Jerseyans. So I think it's sort of a catch-22
for the governor. If people are ambivalent after a lengthy debate and this and he doesn't get it done, I don't think that necessarily is going to be is going to hurt Murphy. It's going to, you know, so, okay, you're accusing me of not getting something done that people are ambivalent about and really are not sure they want. I don't think that's a real radioactive charge I could throw at him.
No, I agree.
But we'll have to see. Maybe it's really hard. I think the polling is kind of squishy, and I think that it could very well be that the public is has made it a priority. I just don't see it. I just don't feel it right now. I think it's just a big revenue grab at heart. Despite all these social issues that everybody are talking about and that need to be addressed. But I think that what's really driving it is the prospect of $300 million, estimated $300 million a year in revenue. That's really what's going on here.
No, absolutely. And, you know, speaking of the governor, obviously whoever his opponent may be and whether or not they hold this as a big campaign issue, you know, Charles, I've had the fortune of having both former Assemblyman Jack Cittarelli on this program. I've had state GOP chairman Doug Steinhardt. I've had other Republicans on this show since it started 2 years ago via my partnership with Insider NJ. And I don't know, Charles, you know what? 2009 was interesting because John Corzine became immensely unpopular midway through his first term. He kind of reminded you about everything you don't like about corporate America, like a corporate guy with no government experience kind of coming in and becoming governor. Republicans kind of were able to ride the coattails of a really polarizing figure of then, you know, former U.S. Attorney Chris Christie. It doesn't seem like there's a Republican right now that is that sort of forceful personality. And that's, again, now while Christie only beat John Corzine, I believe, by 4 or 5 points, I mean, independents really made that election. I think that's what made Christie's election possible in November 2009. I think someone like Cittarelli, who a lot of people call the favorite right now, again, that could change. But whether it's Cittarelli or Steinhardt or anybody, Charles, I don't know, man. If independents are not motivated to come out and vote to oppose Murphy, I could see the governor winning re-election just on the fact that it seems like the state Republican Party cannot get out of its own way and get their blank together, if you know what I'm saying, bro.
If you look at the registration trending, it just gets more and more blue every month. I mean, places like Somerset County are all Democratic freeholder board. Hunterdon is growing in Democratic registration. The percentages, the increased percentages in Hunterdon, Morris, Somerset, even Ocean, are outpacing the Republican percentages of growth. And I think the statewide margin now is 900,000, closing in on 1 million more Democrats and registered Republicans, even though, as you know, unaffiliated are the biggest block. But that's but as a measurement, that's a huge deal. And so you have that. You have, frankly, on top of that, you have Trump is radioactive in this state, you know, with some exceptions. I mean, certainly down where Jeff Andrew is and in that district, Cape May County, parts of Atlantic, Ocean, and the northern Warren and Sussex. But those aren't population centers. They don't really run the table here. Their influence is limited. So, and their numbers are small. So you have Trump, you have Democrats, you know, overtaking a place like Carpenter Ants. So,
it's a very tough environment. And the third thing is the party was in shambles after Chris Christie, and it hasn't really rebounded. They're not in power. The party that's not in power has always struggled to raise money. And all the money is flowing to the Democrats. So you don't have numbers. You have a radioactive president, and you have a party that's struggling to maintain its relevancy, although they have shown some surprising successes in the last legislative election. I'll give them that. And so that backdrop is a very difficult environment for the Republicans to run on.
I agree with
even
you.
And I don't think it's going to improve dramatically in the next year.
I agree with you. And I think, and speaking of that, obviously, you know, the Republican Party is certainly very interesting in New Jersey as opposed to the sort of the national climate and the following. You know, Charles, again, we'll get back to some state stuff in a moment, but I've talked about it on the show repeatedly. I had Bridget Harrison on the show a couple weeks ago, certainly one of the Democrats front in the primary to challenge the new Republican, Jeff Van Drew, down in South Jersey. But it sort of gives us a reminder about the national picture. And, Charles, I'm going to paint you a scenario. You tell me where I'm wrong or maybe where I'm right. But I have gone on record on this show multiple times, and I have said I object a lot to the president's lack of decorum. I object a lot to the president's lack of civility. He tweets way too much for my liking. There are times that, you know, for my age, I've seen a good handful of presidents in my lifetime, whether I've agreed or disagreed with Barack Obama or George W. Bush or Bill Clinton or George H.W. Bush, there was always an element of, you know, them being presidential and a certain type of tactfulness in the office. And clearly we have not seen that with the 45th president. Having said that, on a national level, and again, New Jersey is sort of a very different anomaly because it's still very expensive to live here. I kind of blame the legislature more. I don't really blame Washington for that. I think I blame Trenton more. But on a national level, though, Charles, it seems like aside from two trade deals that on paper at least look to benefit Americans for the future with jobs, with manufacturing jobs coming here, with unemployment numbers that are very favorable for people of color, for women, for Latino home ownership is at an all-time high nationally. We are seeing criminal justice reform. We've seen what I would argue is, because I'm more of a center-right guy, you know, centrist judges being nominated to the federal judiciary. Listen, you don't have to like the guy, and he's very unlikable at times. But for a lot of people, the president's getting things done. And with all the chaos in the Democratic Party right now, and no, not a real strong candidate to oppose the president, I kind of see the president not cruising to reelection, but I could see the president realistically winning this November and getting the second term. Where am I off here with my analysis, or maybe am I putting the cart before the horse?
Well, I mean, I think it's very real that he could win a second term. I think that's going back to what we said this outset of the show, the deep anxiety about the nominee. The Democrats feel that if they don't get a nominee that's acceptable to broad America, that they're toast, that Trump is going to win. And because he, all those, you know, positives that are really basically his, you know, a string of that we're going to hear as sound bites on the campaign trail. I mean, we could debate them all day long, but that's what they're going to be. They're going to be packaged by, you know, a reality TV show star, successful marketing, a figure who knows how to advertise and promote his brand to his base. He's going to have a unified party behind him. And with the economy percolating, a lot of people in the middle are going to say, well, look, I think this is the fear I hear from the Democrats is, well, look, you know, a lot of people in middle America are going to say, yeah, I don't like Trump. There's a lot I don't like, but, you know, the economy's not so bad. My 401k isn't so bad.
And why do I want to change horses in midstream? And by the way, they want to put up a democratic socialist. I don't agree with it. So let's roll for another term. That's what the Democrat, that is the heart of the Democrats' fear right now. And they haven't come up with an answer to counter it.
Charles, it's interesting. Yesterday, I know James Carville, who is as renowned a political operative as there has been. I mean, I remember obviously the famous words during the Clinton campaign, it's the economy, stupid. And I think that that's always defined James Carville throughout his career,
yeah.
Right? In terms of his brash and really sort of unapologetic analysis. I know that the Sanders campaign went after him. And I don't know if you saw it today in the newsfeed, but James Carville just very simply responded back to the Sanders campaign and said, hey, well, at least I'm not a communist. What did you think of that sort of exchange? And do you think that that's where a lot of moderate Democrats are sort of looking at the party right now, where, you know, the more moderate Democrats, you know, in the South and Midwest might say, well, yeah, I'm a strong, you know, I'm a proud Democrat, but I'm not a fan of the party moving so far to the left. And whether it's someone like Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, you know, do you see that ultimately as something that could doom the Democratic Party in the next cycle?
Oh yeah, I agree. I think that's what people are worried about is, you know, that this country, you know, quite frankly, if they really took a harsh look at our government and the way we govern, there's threads of socialism woven into our fabric. I mean, everything's income tax, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security are all socialized programs, so social forms of socialism. So, you know, it's not like it's a totally alien concept to our form of capitalists. But the idea of having a candidate with that word in his part of his resume, part of his calling card, having that word socialist, is just too easy for a Trump to just exploit that. 24/7, and with a party that's galvanized behind him, just pounding away at that. It's just too much of a risk, and that's why they're looking for alternatives. They're even looking at an alternative in the former Republican turned independent, turned Democrat, Mike Bloomberg.
Which is really funny, right? I mean, you would never have expected that during the election cycle.
I mean, if you listen to his defense of stop and frisk, though, I mean, not just the tape that's going around, but there's even, you know, other radio broadcasts, clips from other radio shows. I mean, he was an ardent, passionate defender of this, and he laid it on his view was simple. It was clear. Most of the crime occurs in communities of color, and that's where we have to be aggressive, and I'm sorry, he was totally unapologetic about it,
and he defended it.
I'm sorry.
You know, it's amazing that it has not sunk him, as we discussed earlier. Like, you would think that, but again, nothing should shock us anymore about our political climate, though, right, Charles? I mean, I think that someone like the president. Well, again, I think I outlined the character debate about him, and you know, traditionally, any other sitting president that has said what the president has said would have had his presidency sunk. And the president has avoided all these bullets, has avoided all these landmines. And it seems
right.
I think we've become accustomed to that. So why should the Bloomberg defense of a policy that's only 5 years ago he defended so staunchly, why should it surprise us?
It's a good point.
Good
point. I think that's a good point. I mean, it's like if Stormy Daniels and you could just go down the whole litany of things that should have doomed anybody else didn't harm Donald Trump, he's kind of set a new threshold for what's acceptable. He's now basically made it easier in a way for candidates with baggage to kind of hang in there and thrive and look for redemption on the trail if they want to.
No, absolutely
Mike Bloomberg has to look at Donald Trump. Well, you know, these 20 things didn't destroy Donald Trump. Maybe I can, you know, maybe stop and frisk is not as, you know, life-threatening, career-threatening as it looks initially.
No, absolutely. And you know what? It's one of those things that we'll have to see what happens in the weeks and months ahead. Folks, it's 10:11 here on the East Coast, and he's been a gentleman tonight. I know that he's had a long day. He's very tired. The great political columnist from NorthJersey.com and the Morgan Record, Charles Stile, joining us tonight. Charles, before I let you go, a couple of things here. I know it's been a long day, so I appreciate you being a gentleman with me. Number one, you've been such an informative guest tonight. I feel like I could have you on for 3 more hours, and we still would not get through everything. So,
no,
you
I
have
fall
just
asleep,
been a,
though.
No, you know, listen, you've been a wealth of information tonight. I certainly hope you've enjoyed your time with me here this evening. I think we've had a great conversation dissecting the political climate, not just statewide, but nationally. I certainly want you back on the show. I don't want to speak for you, but I think we've had a great time tonight. So you'll definitely want to come back on, right, bro?
Okay. Yeah. Just give me a, you know, let's see how the election shapes out.
Sure. No, I definitely want to have you back on maybe later this spring, and maybe as budget season heats up here in New Jersey, I definitely want to have you back on to sort of talk about that, because it'll continue to dominate the news cycle. So I want to thank you for your time.
It's going to be a big one. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Sure. Give me a shout.
I want to thank you for your time. And secondly, this is the part of the show where I give the floor to my guests, because I've been the one asking the questions. So this is where I say to you, sir, if you got a question for me or you want to pick my brain, Mr. Stile, the floor is yours.
No, I don't. I'm out of questions. I mean, I thought we had a nice discussion. So, no, I'm good. I didn't come prepared with any questions. Let me ask you this: did you make it down to Wildwood for the rally?
I did not. I unfortunately, I was teaching during the day. I'm a faculty member at Bergen Community College in Paramus. So,
it's a long drive.
Yeah, it's a long drive. I mean, I live in Hudson County. I live in Union City, and you know, by the time I would have been done teaching and driving down there, I would not have made it. I do have some connections at the state level where I could have gotten in there, but you know what? I had a lot of people on social media, Facebook Live-ing the event, Instagram Live. So I felt like I was there watching that. And of course, you know, it was covered in all the major media outlets. But, you know, I know the president mentioned something about maybe teasing the fact of possibly coming to MetLife this summer. I don't know if the president could sell out MetLife. I mean, God knows that both occupants there, the Jets and Giants, can't sell out that building, even if they were giving away money. So maybe the president could do that. I don't know. I did not have a chance to go down there. No, I did not.
Yeah. No, I will say this. I was expecting more of Trump unhinged, to be honest with you. And I thought it was a pretty low-key performance in the grand scheme of Trump performances. I was waiting for him to tee off on John Bolton, and he looked like it looked fairly tame. Well, that doesn't mean he didn't say outrageous things and didn't beat up on the media every 20 seconds. I mean, it seems like every time that the energy got low, he hit the fake news button on his console. Okay, let me give the crowd a little fake news red meat, and as soon as he trashed the media, the crowd started pounding their chests and roaring for more. But by and large, I felt it was a pretty tame event. I think maybe it was right before the impeachment vote, and Bolton was still a wild card. And my guess is he didn't want to provoke him, didn't want to say something so outrageous about John Bolton that would prompt him to have a press conference on this, on the White House, on Pennsylvania Avenue and trash Trump in public.
No, sure.
So I think he was under on his best behavior.
No, he was. And subsequently the week after at the State of the Union, he was also very measured. And, you know, when the president wants to be measured and wants to read from a script, like I think like any president reading from a teleprompter, I think they can execute well. But obviously, as you mentioned, when the president decides to sort of shoot and just sort of, you know, not have a filter, that's what's most entertaining. But Charles, again, I want to thank you for your time.
Sure.
You've been a gentleman. And certainly, again, I hope you tell everybody that you're a fan of Politically Direct. And again,
oh,
I hope that.
In a word.
Oh, I appreciate that. And again, thanks for the follow on Twitter. Keep up the great work, Charles. And we'll talk to you again soon here on Politically Direct. Well,
and stop in at the State House and say hello next time you're down there.
I will. I certainly will, bro. Thank you so much. Keep
okay.
up the great work,
talk
man. And we'll talk to you soon. Have a good night.
All right. Take care now. Bye-bye.
Take care now. All right, folks. Unbelievable. Great episode tonight here on Politically Direct. What can you say, folks? You know, Charles Stiles, a great columnist. I read his work often, whenever I can. Obviously, I read a lot in the news cycle, not just statewide, but nationally. So, you know, great job there. And I think a great conversation this evening with Charles to really get to the heart of the matter of not just New Jersey politics, but I think also a little bit discussion of the national climate and really how he sees it, how he sees the political climate right now, and also how he sees the field of Democrats running against the president. So we're looking forward to having Charles Stiles, the esteemed columnist from NorthJersey.com and also the Bergen Record, coming up later this spring. Again, as budget season heats up, folks, I definitely want to have the great guests. And as I said before, you know, Charles Stiles is just another outstanding example of the long line of guests that I bring you on the show and how hard I work to make the show informative, entertaining often at times, but also educational, because really there's a lot to talk about in New Jersey politics. So a great show again tonight with him. Folks, if you missed any part of tonight's broadcast, do me a favor. Go to www.insidernj.com/podcasts. You can download the episode from any PC, Mac, smartphone, or tablet, and you can listen to it anywhere at any time this evening or whenever you want, on your way to work tomorrow, when you're driving, maybe when you're taking the train and you've downloaded it. Tune in. Let me know what you think. Again, Charles Stiles, what a wealth of information he brought us tonight, folks. So if you have not, you know, again, you know, listen to the show in its entirety, it will be available at the bottom of the hour here, 10:30 Eastern time. It'll be available. So again, tune in for it and share it again whenever you can on all of your social media. Again, folks, if you have a topic or an issue you want me to discuss, or you have a guest you'd like to hear from in the coming weeks and months, write to me, politicallydirectnj@yahoo.com. Don't forget to follow the show on Instagram @politicallydirectnj. You can also follow me directly as well @ProfessorFernandiUribe. I can't say enough about the support, really, you guys give me on Instagram. I know you love my stories. I know you love my political memes, my pro wrestling memes, my pop culture memes, everything in between, really. So I really appreciate everyone and their support on Instagram. Don't forget to hit me up on Twitter, folks, @ProfessorFDRibe. Don't forget to like Politically Direct on Facebook. Brand new followers and likes every day. People sharing the page. People telling everyone about the podcast. And again, ladies and gentlemen, I can't say enough. Don't forget that every Thursday night live at 9 p.m., you can listen to the best analysis and the best commentary about everything going on in not just New Jersey's political climate, but the national scene as well. And it's always right here on Politically Direct. You can listen to all episodes by going to www.insidernj.com/podcast. And as a reminder, don't forget to check out Insider NJ by going to www.insidernj.com. Again, for the best coverage of the political scene anywhere in the state of New Jersey. Once you go on the website, click on the upper right-hand corner, the subscribe button, and you'll see the your ability to do that, and you'll be enrolled automatically for free in the Morning Intelligence Briefing. And again, you'll get all the great columns, which start with our editor-in-chief, Max Pizarro, my other great teammates in the lineup, again, leading off, you know, Matt Leadoff, Jay Lasseter. You have other great hitters in the lineup there, Fred Snowflack, Al Sullivan, and many more. So I'm proud to be on the Insider NJ team. But again, folks, you can't go wrong with the journalism that Insider NJ brings you. Again, www.insidernj.com. Don't forget to follow them on Twitter and also like them on Facebook. And folks, again, don't forget to start and end your day with Insider NJ. And again, folks, we're coming up here to the end. I want to wish everybody a very happy Valentine's Day. I'm looking forward to tomorrow, having a nice dinner tomorrow. So it'll be a good Valentine's Day for me and hopefully for all of you. Also, please be careful this weekend. It is President's Day weekend, so do party responsibly. Again, be careful when you go out there this weekend to celebrate President's Day weekend. I'm sure there'll be a lot of parties, and nightlife will be popping all throughout the Garden State. And, of course, across the river in New York City as well. And so whether it's on your morning commute, folks, getting your daily workout, walking your dog, doing your laundry, whatever it is, even for my students, hopefully working on their research papers that's due coming up, take a break, tune in, and you'll be happy that you did. And never forget, folks, it's real. It's here. It is Politically Direct. Good night. Trenton, New Jersey, all my good people in the capital of the Garden State, tune in tonight. Appreciate your support here on the program. And without you, my loyal listening audience, the success of this show would not be possible. So I love you all. God bless you all. Enjoy it. As a matter of fact, also, folks, don't forget to enjoy NBA All-Star Weekend from Chicago. Should be some very fun festivities. Also very somber with the recent death and passing of Laker legend Kobe Bryant. I'm sure they'll have a very nice presentation to honor the late, great NBA superstar. So aside from that somber impact, if you're a basketball fan like me, enjoy NBA weekend, All-Star weekend, again, from Chicago. So we'll see what they bring us, again, from the National Basketball Association. So, folks, we'll see you here next week on Blog Talk Radio as Bloomberg editor, really, and she's a great lady. She's been on the show before. Stacey Sherman joins us here on the podcast again live next Thursday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Folks, put on your calendars, and don't forget, it's going to be a great, great program again from the editor's desk at Bloomberg News. The great Stacey Sherman joins us here next week on Blog Talk Radio. So I'll see you next week, folks. Enjoy the holiday weekend, and don't forget, let's keep on talking.
Bring it.